petition.
All right, so I have made no more headway on understanding Bobachev Gross myself. Therefore, I'm going to talk about a slightly different approach or a different place one should look. And that's a series of three papers by Cremona, Fisher, O'Neill, Simon, and Stahl, which is called Explicit and Descent on Elliptic Curves, 1, 2, 3. And actually, part one is called Algebra, part two is called Geometry, and part three is called Algorithms. And before you get too excited about algorithms, the algorithms themselves only really apply when we're working with elliptic curves over number fields. I mean, the ideas behind the algorithms apply in principle, but they're not implemented except in number fields. So we can't just exactly plug in this work. But the basic setup of what these guys are trying to do, in principle, works over any perfect field, which includes all fields of characteristic zero. And so this is an approach to studying the problem. So what we're going to be studying today is elliptic curves over some field K. And for our application, we want to think of K as being the function field, the fraction field, field of fractions, of the coordinate ring of some variety B. And I kind of think of this as coming from some family of elliptic curves over B and studying the generic point of that family. So that's a typical sort of thing that we've done. But we'll just look at the generic point here. And there are three interesting groups that will show up. One is the Mordell-Day group of E, which is simply the group of k-valued points. So a k-valued point, so here I'm thinking of E as being over spec k, and k-valued point has the geometric interpretation of a map going back in the other direction. And so over here in my family, it would actually only be a rational map. The map might not extend to the full base if you had a k-value point like this, but the group of k-value points, and it is a group because the elliptic curve is a group, is one of the groups that we're interested in. The second group that we're interested in is the Tate-Shafarevich group of E, which is approximately the E torsors, but there are some conditions about E torsors which, if you reduce, if you localize at primes of k, at places of k, which means primes in the coordinate ring of k, primes in some ring whose fraction field is k, then you actually have points, right? So there should be E torsors which are locally trivial in some appropriate sense. The Calabi-Yau torsors that I'm interested in for the applications to geometry might not completely satisfy this Tate-Shafarevich condition, so this approach needs to be thought about a little bit carefully in trying to solve that problem, but I think it's a really interesting approach to thinking about the whole problem. And then there's something called the Selmer group, or rather the N-Selmer group of E. And the N-Selmer group is the thing that's going to be directly described by this project, and it has the very nice property that there's an exact sequence from the, this was supposed to be square brackets for some reason, the k-value points. There's an exact sequence from the k-value points mod n torsion, mod n times the k-value points. So what is this typically? This is typically a finitely presented abelian group, finitely generated abelian group, so it'll have a free part and a torsion part, and this will keep n torsion or stuff dividing n torsion and turn all the free part into additional n torsion, right? So there's an exact sequence going from this to this nth Selmer group of E over K 2, the Tate-Shaw-Fravitch group, I forgot to tell you the notation, you're supposed to use this letter Shaw from Russian for Shaw-Fravitch, and we'll take the end torsion part. And this is actually gets abbreviated E of N as well, which is the end torsion points. It's not consistent notation, but it's what people do. So there's an expectation that the Tate-Shaw-Fravitch group is finite, and so if that expectation is true, then this provides a method of finding the Tate-Shaw-Fravitch group if you could find all of the n Selmer groups. And if you knew something about the order of the Tate-Shaw-Fravitch group, or if you were interested in elements of particular orders, then you could analyze them in this way. So the Selmer group is more computable. It mixes together the Mordovay and the Tate-Shaw-Fravitch group. And that's actually interesting to me because of the interpretations in the context of F-theory. So let me just quickly tell you what happens with each of these groups in terms of F-theory. So the Tate-Shaw-Fravitch group of E over K is closely related to the problem we're trying to solve, to the group of Calabi-Yau e-torsors. And that group of Calabi-Yau e-torsors, is supposed to be the component group for the gauge group, the total gauge group of the F-theory model. So, F-theory models have gauge groups. What is a gauge group? G is some compact Lie group, which is associated to the F-theory model. It's pretty easy to figure out the Lie algebra of G. So this is easily computable from geometric data. But it's much harder to figure out the global structure. I know a lot of you have know enough Lie theory now that I can point out the basic structure of a compact Lie group. So a compact Lie group is going to have a commutator. And if you mod out by the commutator, you're going to get the maximal abelian quotient. Modding out by the commutator gives you the maximal abelian quotient. And on the other hand, there's inside of G a maximal abelian subalgebra, subgroup. And if you project T to A, this has a finite kernel. So people don't often talk about the abelian part of the compact group, but there is an abelian part, and you can sort of analyze the structure here. If you look at the semi-symbol part, so I've got a kernel of this map alpha. Kernel of alpha is semi-simple. Then the semi-simple part actually breaks as a product of simple factors. And each of those simple factors has potentially a finite fundamental group. So the order of pi 1 of this guy is less than infinity. If I'm given the simple Lie algebra, there is a simply connected compact, I'm working over the reals, right? There's a simply connected compact Lie group, which is associated to it. And each of those simply connected compact Lie groups has a finite center. And you're allowed to mod out by any subgroup of that center and get another compact Lie group with the same algebra. And so then the stuff you modded out by would be the pi 1. And so from this, you can work out that the overall pi 1 of G is a finitely generated group And the free part basically corresponds to A, and the torsion part corresponds to the product of these pi 1 of Qj's. That's the pi 1 of the semisimple part. So all of that information is sort of contained in the abstract thing of pi 1 of G. And so if I have a connected compact Lie group, and I know pi 1 of G, that and I know what the algebra is, I can work out what the algebra is, that will essentially tell me how to reconstruct the data. So the data of G and pi 1 of G determines a connected compact group. The groups in question for us might be disconnected. I already mentioned that pi 0 of G is going to play a role. And so you also, if you want to know about the disconnected part, you need to know how the component group works. And I guess in the examples, the component groups always turn out to be abelian, although many of my physicist friends tell me that they're just waiting for the non-abelian examples to show up. And I think in the abelian case, the group itself will be determined if I know pi 0 and pi 1 in the algebra. And in the non-abelian case, I think there might be some issue about determining the group. You might need a little bit of extra data to explain how the component group acts. Okay. So the physical interpretation of, the G, as I mentioned, is determined by the geometry. So that's determined by the Kodaira types of singular fibers, essentially. Or rather, the semi-simple part of it is, and the abelian part, you know how to make an abelian algebra, no problem. And then pi 1 of G is exactly supposed to be equal to the Mordovay group of the curve, the group of, I didn't use that notation, E of K. So here I have an exact sequence relating the torsion in pi 1 and the N torsion in pi 0 and some group built out of those. And I've been aware of this summer group for a few years, and I've been trying to think, is there some natural way I can describe some object that captures N torsion both in the component group and the fundamental group? And I haven't really thought of what that is, but there must be some natural meaning, I would think, to attach to the entire summer group. Okay, anyway, that's the group that we can kind of get out of elliptic curve theory, and it's related to these two crucial pieces of information for determining the gauge group in F theory, namely pi 0 and pi 1. So because this has only N torsion information, it's not going to completely determine everything. But if you knew this for essentially all N's, right, you would then completely determine pi 1 because it's got this finitely generated free part. Those will each give Z mod N Z factor every time you do the summer group, and so if there's other stuff, it'll show up as torsion, and then if there are, if it's true that Tetchoff-Ravitch is only a finite group, then those terms will show up for only a finite number of n's, so the behavior for general n will tell you what the free part of the group is. Okay, so that's sort of the background. And the story of this thing is going to be about the structure of E over N, or rather the function field of E over N, as an extension of K, which is the basic ground field we're working with. And geometrically, I can think of it like this. I've got spec K, and I've got my elliptic curve E here. And if I look at the end torsion points, well, over an algebraically closed field, there are n squared points. But I'm not over an algebraically closed field, so typically I've got the Galois group of k bar over k acting on that set of n squared geometric points. It'll form a certain number of orbits, and this E of n will break up into a certain collection of fields, right? And geometrically, I can think of it in the following way. In my case where I have a family of elliptic curves over a base B, then my n torsion points form some kind of n squared sheeted cover of this guy. Now, there is a particular guy, which is the identity. So I know there is at least one point among my n squared, which is distinguished. But then the rest of it will split up somehow, and I'm interested in the ring extensions that I get from these various covers. So there doesn't have to be a uniformity in how it splits up, but there is a restriction on it, which I'm about to explain. So there's a general feature of n torsion points on elliptic curves over arbitrary fields. Which I'm going to explain over the complex numbers and then assert to you that it's been worked out in sort of algebraic form as well. And it comes from the fact that the first homology group, so temporarily K will be C, first homology group of E with integer coefficients has a natural pairing on it, maps to the second cohomology group, so the cut product pairing, and the second cohomology group is just isomorphic to Z. So there's this cut product pairing of classes in H1 giving me an element of Z, and this is skew symmetric since I'm working with odd cohomology groups. So there's any elliptic curve has this skew symmetric pairing. It induces a pairing on the end torsion, which I can basically identify with H1 of E with Zn coefficients. Looks like the end torsion points. So I get a map from end torsion points to end torsion points to Z mod n, but it's actually important to call it mu n for these purposes, because that's the form in which they gave an algebraic description of the same thing. So there's a pairing, which in the complex numbers is inherited from the pairing on topological cohomology, which is called the Vey pairing. So now K is arbitrary. There's a pairing called the Vey pairing, which takes in some nice functorial algebraic way, two n torsion points, or you know, we can think of these as schemes, right? Kernel of multiplication by n on the group into mu n, which by the way is the kernel. It's just spec k x mod x n minus one, which has a natural multiplication on it. So the fact that there's that Vey pairing is something that has to be somehow preserved when I study the geometry. So there's got to be this scheme map from En cross En, cross En to this guy, spec kx over x to the n minus 1. In characteristic 0, that's, I could have called it Zn, but you also want it to behave well when you specialize mod primes. And if you're in a situation where some residue fields might have characteristic P, it's useful to have presented it in this way. And so this Vey pairing is actually at the heart of the algebraic construction that these guys give to get started with understanding the Selmer group. So they're interested in R, which they call the et al. Algebra of E of N, and it's essentially the product of coordinate fields, I mean fraction fields of coordinate rings of the irreducible components of E of N. So I can write En as a union of irreducible components. And take all their fraction fields and get an algebra. So there are two homomorphisms that these guys define that they kind of need for making everything work. So the Selmer group is going to be described, I should have mentioned this, the Selmer group is going to be described in terms of cohomology of K with coefficients in this guy E of N. And one of the homomorphisms is a map to the units in the et al. Algebra mod the nth powers of units. And this map is injective. And the image is known. And the other map is going to be a sort of refinement of the first one, which goes into the units in the tensor square modulo the image under some morphism that we have to describe. And this is also injective with known image. And there's also going to be an obstruction map, which goes from H1K E of N into everybody's favorite, the Bauer group of the field K. And in order to represent an element of the Selmer group, this obstruction map has to vanish. So you have to be in the kernel of the obstruction map, and the warning that they give is that OB is not a homomorphism, and the kernel of OB is not a group, need not be a group. So the Selmer group is a group, so there is some subgroup which is contained in the obstruction group, which turns into elements of the of this guy. So a lot of the story in these couple of papers is about different ways of representing either elements of this cohomology group or elements of the Selmer group. Let me tell you the basic ingredient for defining these maps W. And I apologize. Turned out there was a talk about the black hole discovery at 2 o'clock, which I hadn't realized, and it interrupted my preparation. Right, so I'm going to use the Vey pairing. To define something called W. So I'll map En to R cross, which I'm thinking of maps of En to K cross. map. I mean, I'm not sure what category these guys are in, but if I'm looking at the coordinate ring at this Etal algebra, it looks like the union of the coordinate rings on this guy, and each of the coordinate rings would have been, the non-zero elements in the coordinate ring would have been the maps from one of the components to K cross. So that's what this is. And I define W by, if I take an element of E of n and evaluate it on another element of E of n, then I'm supposed to get the this Vey pairing sub n of the two guys. So that gives the essential structure that's used to produce these other homomorphisms. I can write down definitions of W1. If you have an element C and you modify it by a Galois guy, then you get to write it in the form sigma of gamma over gamma. And if I take alpha, which is defined to be gamma to the n, that's an element of R cross, which is Galois invariant. So it's Galois invariant. And if I take rho, which is, I forgot to write the exact sequence. So there's an exact sequence from E of n, W, R cross, delta, R tensor R cross. And the definition of delta is that delta alpha on T1, T2 is alpha of T1, alpha of T2, over alpha of T1 plus T2. If you add two n torsion points, you get another n torsion point. Delta alpha. Alpha is an element of R cross. So we're evaluating, it's a function on the n torsion points, right? So we're evaluating this function on T1, on T2, and on their sum, which is also an n torsion point. And that gives us something which is naturally well-defined on pairs. Okay, so rho, which is delta applied to gamma, is in R cross, tensor R cross. And I should have mentioned that this H1 I'm doing is Galois cohomology. So you take, didn't mention that. So you take the algebraic closure, you take elements in the algebraic closure, you look at how the Galois group acts, and look for invariant things. And so this is the information that you need to define W1 to be alpha times it's the coset alpha times R cross to the n, and W2 is just this rho times delta R cross. So that defines these funny maps. I'm writing it out explicitly. You guys can look it up in the paper. I'm writing it out explicitly so that you can see that there are these really explicit ways of describing the elements in question. Okay, so I now realize I've done things slightly out of order because I should have explained why that Galois cohomology group is related to the Selmer group that I was talking about. But more generally, if you have an element of the Galois cohomology group with these two maps, W1 and W2, and if that obstruction map, which goes to the Bauer group, vanishes, then there is some kind of hope of producing an element of the n-Selmer group. So let me mention what the goal of the whole business is. So the goal is to represent each element of the n-Selmer group by an elliptic, so-called elliptic normal curve, C in P n minus 1, which is an e-torsion. So let me explain how elements of the Mordovais group would lead to elliptic normal curves. I mean, why that should be part of the story. And that is simply that I can take the section that I'm given by the element of the Mordovais group, which I think of as maybe a point. I can take n times that section and look at the line bundle on the elliptic curve represented by n times that section. And that line bundle gives me an embedding, the linear system associated to that guy gives me an embedding of C into Pn minus 1. So there's some geometry associated with the Mordovais part. There's also some geometry associated with the Tate-Shafarevich part, where you have in the n-torsion part of Tate-Shafarevich, you're expecting to have no points defined over k of the twisted elliptic curve of the e-torsor, but something which is defined over a degree n extension of k, so you would have an n-fold point rather than a point. If you have an n-fold point, you can make the same sort of construction to associate a line bundle to it, look at the map defined by the line bundle, and that should give you an embedding from C into P n minus 1. So their idea is to start from some cohomological analysis of this Selmer group, to use a map like this to produce data which in principle ought to tell them how to get an elliptic normal curve, and then to learn how to extract from this data, namely an element of this group in which you had assumed that this obstruction map vanished, and somehow produce equations for the elliptic normal curve, which gives the e-torsor. So in principle, this ought to give a way of starting with an elliptic curve E and generating the various elliptic normal curves, which are its e-torsors, and including cases where it's trivial as an e-torsor, but comes from some interesting point, extra point from the Mordovais group on the curve. So it's not an unreasonable thing from a geometer's perspective to be trying to do. And I should mention that if n is equal to 2, of course it's not an embedding. If n equals 2, this map that we're talking about is a 2-to-1 map. So in that case, we're trying to represent the e-torsor by a 2-to-1 map. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about this obstruction, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit about their strategy for how you would use this algebraic formulation in terms of these funny maps and then somehow generate equations defining the curve. As I said, part one of the paper is called Algebra, and it involves, it's where these W1 and W2 and the obstruction map are discussed. And then number two is geometry, where you try to take that data and turn it into equations for the curve. And then in part three, they discuss explicit algorithms for implementing this idea over when K is a number field. So the explicit algorithm part is not, I don't think, going to directly apply to the problem that we've been thinking about. Okay, so to tell you about the obstruction map, I have to tell you one way of representing elements in H1E coefficients in K of N. They can be represented by C's mapping to S's, where S is a Brauer-Savary variety over K of dimension n minus 1. So what's a Brauer-Savary variety of K of dimension n minus 1? It's something which, if you base change from S 2, so S loads over spec K, and if you base change to the algebraic closure, producing S bar, S bar is isomorphic to P n minus 1 K bar. So those of you who are taking the algebraic geometry class, we saw the very first case of this. If we talk about Brouwer severity varieties of dimension 1, the question is, what algebraic curves are there, S over spec K, with the property that if you base change to the algebraic closure, you would get P1. And the answer is that you can have conics with no points. Right? So anytime you have a curve of genus 0, there's a natural map into P2 that you get by looking at the anti-canonical system on the curve. Sorry, the curve is called S right now. It's a little misleading, but it's a curve. And so that gives you a degree 2 curve in P2, which may or may not have points. The question of whether it has points or not is somehow related to is somehow related to K cross mod K cross squared. And so the structure of units in the field mod squares, the reason that's relevant is you would like to, if you have the equation in the form of a conic and you base change to the algebraic closure, then you'll be able to take a square root of some coefficient and write the thing in standard form where it's clear it has a point. And so the obstruction to doing that was somehow the coefficient in front of some term in the conic divided by the possible squares, right? You could modify the coefficient by squares over your field, but over a non-algebraically closed field, this is typically a non-trivial group. In the geometric context, where K is the function field of some base manifold B, base variety B, then we're talking about conic bundles in the case of n equal 2. So we would do conic bundles over B, which may or may not have points. And of course, there's also this phenomenon that if you think about it over a base of interesting dimension, then there may be degenerations of the conics. So you would have thought that it's a map, and it's a degree 2 map if n equals 2, but it should be an embedding if n is bigger than 2. So this is degree 2 if n equals 2, and it's an embedding otherwise. So you might have thought that everything could be represented by maps which were embeddings into Pn minus 1, but actually, if you're doing things carefully, what you realize is that you get an embedding into something which is a Brouwer severity variety, and so only goes into it doesn't give you actually Pn minus 1, but gives you something which, after going to the algebraic closure, gives Pn minus 1. However, there is a nice construction which comes out of the theory of these Brouwer groups and Brouwer severity varieties, which is that there's always a map from S cross S to Pn squared minus 1. In other words, if you have a Brouwer severity variety and you make the corresponding Segre-type map, you end up with a variety which is now trivial in the Brouwer group, or something which is trivial in the Brouwer group. And that's the basic geometric idea that these guys are trying to exploit. What they want to do is they want to take an element of the Selmer group, they want to realize the element as a C over S, ask the question whether they can pull back from Pn, so there's an embedding into Pn squared minus 1, that's actually related to this R tensor R business, and ask whether they can actually pull it back in such a way that it came from Pn minus 1 cross Pn minus 1, into there instead of some twisted version of Pn minus 1. So there's a construction which I won't try to describe, which associates to elements of the summer group, or more generally elements of this guy, a pair C over S, and the obstruction map applied to C over S is just the class of S in the Brouwer group of K. So the general idea, let's see, so why would this be a reasonable thing to do? If I pass to the algebraic closure, which is what I'm trying to do in Galois cohomology, then I can definitely use this kind of construction to embed my elliptic curve into Pn minus 1. And now I have to use the Galois action. And the Galois action on the elliptic curve will reduce me back to the C, the twisted guy that I started with. And the Galois action on the embedding Pn minus 1 potentially leaves me with something from the Brouwer group, right? So that's why it's natural to associate some kind of map from C to S to an element of here. Of course, being able to decide whether an S that you've been given is trivial in the Brouwer group or not is one of the tricky issues, right? If I have a conic bundle, do I have a section of my conic bundle? Or if I've written down a conic explicitly over a non-algebraically closed field, is there a point on that conic or not? So that's the place where in part three they develop algorithms tuned to the case of number fields where they might be able to determine whether or not something had a section, and understanding how that part works in this broader context is going to be hard.
Can you say more about the, I mean, is it possible to say something about the invariance of the, and in this case it's a curve, but if it's a, can you say the genus of the curve or something, depending on the...
C is a curve of genus 1, right? C is just a twist of E. It's one of these E torsors. So there's an action of E on C, and it's faithful, right? So the point is that if I had lifted to the algebraic closure, it would have been just E cross E mapping to E. There wouldn't have been any possible choice of twisting, but the Galois action is an interesting one. So when I have an action like this, which came from an n-torsion point, then by using this idea, or maybe some divisor of degree d, of degree n, excuse me, by using this linear system, I get a map into Pn minus 1. And now, again, passing to the algebraic closure, I would just get the usual embedding into Pn minus 1, but the Galois action on C becomes a Galois action on Pn minus 1, which after all is this is the projectivization of the sections of this bundle that I'm looking at, and Galois is acting on it. So the result is some variety defined over K, but it might not be Pn minus 1. Okay, well, anyway, the basic strategy, let me just summarize it once again, is I describe elements of the summer group by means of things from this Galois cohomology, and I think maybe I've now made it fairly clear what you're supposed to do. If you have a twist, which is a point of order of order n, then by base changing, I don't really have to base change all the way to the algebraic closure. What I really have to base change to is the smallest composite field of the component fields of my Étal algebra R. In other words, I have to straighten out all of my components of the set of n torsion points somehow. So I have to have a base change which makes all n squared points distinct. And once I've done that, I have this Galois action. So I have an embedding into Pn minus 1, and I have this Galois action, and so I get a canonical map to some Brouwer severity variety. And the problem is to identify when it's trivial and if it's trivial. So the one other thing which these guys
use as an ingredient, and for the first two papers, they call it a black box. And the black box is for any for any algebra known to be isomorphic, to the n by n matrix algebra over K, the black box should exhibit the isomorphism, exhibit an isomorphism. So known to be isomorphic is, you know, some abstract statement like S is, has a trivial class in the Brouwer group. So if you assume S has a trivial class in the Brouwer group, you have some associated algebra, and the question is, if you do you have an algorithm which would produce an isomorphism to a matrix algebra whenever such an isomorphism exists? And so they work over number fields with some strategies for generating such a guy, and I'm not sure how well we can manipulate the Brouwer groups in the higher dimensional case, but and I'm not sure whether we need the full strength of that black box, but for their purposes of trying to write what the equations of C would be, they use that, and you can kind of see why they would use it. They've got C embedded in Pn minus 1 or embedded in S, which is, S is something which is actually known to be isomorphic to Pn minus 1, so they're going to need a way of exhibiting that isomorphism, and it essentially amounts to, you get an embedding of C into Pn squared minus 1, and then can you somehow pull it back to an embedding in this Pn minus 1 cross Pn minus 1, and then you would get to take a projection to get the embedding in Pn minus 1. Okay, anyway, I tried to sketch in 1 hour three rather long papers to give everybody kind of an idea of some approach. It's not unrelated to the other stuff that we were talking about in terms of this group. It's pretty explicit, but it's also pretty dense in terms of the algebra. My sense is it's a little less dense in terms of the algebra than the Dolgachev and Gross papers, but we should all be studying this. That's kind of the moral of the story. And I will stop there. Any questions?
So what exactly are all the things that we would need to adapt? You said they don't take into consideration the torsors which are trivial?
So there's a step in figuring out exactly what are the Calabi-Yau torsors, which is to decide if you have a torsor, is the total space Calabi-Yau, right? And maybe if one first has a way of analyzing all the torsors, then that question can be secondary, right? Dolgachev and Gross spend a lot of time worrying about multiple fibers, and the multiple fibers business should be handled by something that's kind of implicit in the discussion here, which is that everything should be trivial at each place of the field, right? So, in other words, you take a ring whose fraction field is the field, and you look at primes in that ring, and you take the associated residue fields for those primes, and you ask whether things always trivialize locally like that. And that might be a slightly stronger assumption than we need for our problem, but I would be happy if we understood it even making that assumption, and then we could see where else we had to modify stuff. So most of the work related to this is done by number theorists aimed at understanding questions like what are all the possible twists of an elliptic curve over an arbitrary number field, something that they're interested in because they want to solve Diophantine equations, and that's great. We're interested in a related set of facts. Actually, they're often interested in making models, say, over spec OK, the ring of integers in the number field, and those models are more closely related to the elliptic vibrations that we study. But the first step is always to understand what happens over the function field of the base. All right.